Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Come on, show me the magic.
Can I take you out to the pictures?
Well, I hope you'll come and see me in the movies.
What a scene
of your Hollywood song.
Hello, and welcome to the Beatles Films Podcast. I'm Matt Looker.
I'm Ed Williamson.
We're both professional film writers and Fab Four fans, and each week we discuss a different movie about, starring, or inspired by the Beatles. This week, that film is 1998's The Brian Epstein Story, a made-for-TV documentary about Beatles manager Brian Epstein that originally aired as two episodes split across two nights as part of the BBC Arena documentary series, and which ultimately went on to win a BAFTA. The episodes were then truncated into a 90-minute version and rebroadcast in subsequent years. But let's get into it. Ed, as a film that calls itself The Brian Epstein Story, how well do you think it tells that story? Does it do the man justice?
Well, it's hard to know, isn't it, I suppose, in that these are the sort of source texts that we have to examine to know the kind of man that Brian was. I think that the cast of characters it assembles to do the job of talking heads are people who knew him very well. It certainly is not a documentary that could be accused of, you know, having Steve Diggle say what kind of man he thought Brian Epstein was. Are we going to use Steve Diggle as like shorthand for an unworthy talking head on a documentary?
Now and forevermore.
It seems a bit unfair, to be honest. But anyway, yeah, it's not a documentary that could be accused of skimping on its talking heads. The people in it are people who properly knew him and properly are qualified to talk about him. But I do think that there's a fair bit of surface detail, and it doesn't necessarily always scratch below it.
That was my main takeaway from it. I feel like there's documentaries that I feel do this better. What is it that they're doing differently? I can't really quite put my finger on it, but I came away from watching this thinking that there are lots of nice things and great claims made by those talking heads about Brian Epstein. But I still didn't really feel like the documentary showed that to me. I feel like I was being told it, but I wasn't really given a sense of seeing that play out in any way. Yeah. It might just be down to the fact that there's lack of footage of that to sort of back up those kinds of comments. But the documentary kind of felt like it took a bit of a cold approach to its subject. But at the same time, you have all of these people that were in Brian's life talking about him very warmly.
Yeah, it feels almost like a documentary that's at war with its participants, you know, like they're in a slightly different film than the one it wants to make. I think the way it sort of does its framing is interesting, and that coldness that you speak of, I think a lot of it comes from that. So as you rightly say, subject matter like this, you're often dealing with a sort of dearth of footage, right? Mm. So, you know, if you think about the nuts and bolts that put together a documentary like this, you have your talking heads. They're sitting in a room talking about Brian, and every now and again they might sort of walk down the street. There's an awful lot of people walking down Chapel Street where he lived, and just sort of looking up at his house. And Marianne Faithfull is sort of going out on her balcony in Kensington, it seems like, yes. And just sort of looking out into the distance, you know. So, like, these things are there because the story needs to be driven along in some way, and also that there needs to be some kind of visual stimulus for it not just to be a podcast, basically. But that's fine. It's not that's how documentaries work, you know.
I think there's the it made me think of archive footage I use as well. I think within the first few minutes, I don't know why this struck me, but there was narration talking about Brian, and I guess talking about his legacy, and the footage that was playing over was of the Beatles meeting royalty. And it just kind of struck me as like, well, you're talking about Brian, and you're talking about him being very charismatic, I think it was at the time.
Right.
And then I was looking at the screen. I was like, oh no, wait, there's Brian there at the side. So the Beatles are there meeting royalty, and then there's Brian is also in shot just about. And I was like, it just occurs to me, like, have you used that because it's another shot that just happens to have Brian in, and you've only got so many of those that you can use?
Right.
But it felt like an odd, you'd normally, I guess, while someone's talking about how charismatic a person is, you'd normally show underneath that footage of that person being charismatic, you know, like, and actually having a bit more, showing some personality, smiling at someone or something. It just seemed like an odd choice.
Yeah, actually, you know, it's interesting you bring up that example, because I think that kind of illustrates how sometimes you might watch a documentary and read something into it that is actually just, it was just a practical thing of like, well, that's all they had. Because to be honest, like, I watched that and I thought, oh, that's interesting. Because there's a lot in sort of Brian's story about two worlds colliding, if you like, this idea of him growing up in a very middle class, fairly privileged environment in sort of Liverpool's Jewish community. And then, you know, one of the main mental images you always have in your head, because it's a story that's so often told, is Brian walking from Nems up Matthew Street and into the Cavern, you know, one lunchtime, and being greeted with this whole new world, you know, which he describes in an interview that's on this, and it's in the anthology as well. You know, it's like going down the stairs to this kind of smoky, dank atmosphere, you know, that thing of kind of two worlds colliding. I felt like I was watching that of them meeting the Queen, and I thought, oh, that's interesting. They're sort of making that point visually that this is an environment that Brian is comfortable in, meeting somebody like the Queen. He knows how to behave in those situations. And the Beatles don't necessarily. And that, you know, this is part of what his value was to them. Maybe they're sort of illustrating it with that footage. Or, as you say, it may have just been because that was the only footage they had.
It sounds to me like you're saying that was an artistic choice that delivers an important subtext in the documentary that I just didn't get.
Well, I mean, let's not rule that out. You know? I mean, certainly, previous evidence shows us that we can't rule that out.
It's a tad harsh. It's interesting you talk about that, actually. I think one of the, going back to this idea of the documentary not necessarily getting under the skin of Brian as a person, one of the best points I've felt that was made in the documentary, I think it was Marianne Faithfull, who said that you had these young, talented artists, and they actually needed Brian to be able to bridge that gap to help them be successful in the industry.
Yeah.
Because he was that bit older, and because he was that sort of bit more wealthy and, I guess, more privileged, he was able to, I guess, talk the talk that helped open doors for these artists.
Yeah.
And I hadn't thought about that, and I thought that was really interesting. So it's not necessarily that he saw their talent and harnessed them and then was able to package them in a commercial way, but actually it was... they wouldn't have been able to do that for themselves, because they wouldn't have known how to have those conversations and have those relationships with the people that they'd need to talk to, which I thought was really interesting. But again, that was Marianne Faithfull telling me that, and I don't really feel like the documentary demonstrated that in any way or even expressed that point further. And I felt that was an important... It felt like it was an important explanation as to why we should feel he has such a legacy.
No, that's true. I mean, she's a very interesting talking head in it. To be perfectly honest, I hadn't really realised that she was part of Brian's stable, you know.
Yeah.
And she talks with a great deal of experience of not only the pop industry, but just the 60s in general and that sort of cultural change. And she talks about sort of, you know, I don't know anything about licensing t-shirt deals, you know, yes, it's completely uninteresting to me, you know. And she said, you know, I don't think it's so bad to not be good at that sort of thing. And she was saying that about the guy who was like in charge of people's, you know, commercial future. And actually, like, one of the, if you extend the whole idea of the fact that he was from a different social strata and was able to open doors for them, it also meant that he had a lot of responsibility for these, like, young working class people who just wanted to play music and be paid for it. And I mean, it sounds to me like broadly he did a good job, you know. But I mean, she's sort of talking about a sort of commercial naivety on his point.
Yeah, and I think that's interesting, because I feel like the little that I do know about Brian and his management of the Beatles in particular were that there were business decisions that he made that actually ended up not being as sensible as they could or should have been at the time.
Yeah.
Don't really understand all the nuts and bolts of those things, but I understand broadly that there were some things that maybe he, you know, should have done differently or negotiated differently. Yeah. But yeah, you're right. It's interesting that that Mary Papel makes that point, but and I feel like I'm going to say this a lot. Again, I don't feel like the documentary necessarily went that next step further and explored that more.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it feels like the kind of documentary that would benefit from a voiceover explaining what happened and, you know, and putting a little bit more context around some of those claims.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it, yeah. I mean, yeah, before you gave that example, yeah, I was about to ask, like, you know, what is the distinction between a talking head saying something and the film carrying that forward? But, yeah, that is a good example of the way that the film can do it, is that, you know, a documentary is furthering a narrative.
Yes.
You know, whether it likes it or not, it is furthering a narrative. And The traditional view of documentary is that, we're just presenting the facts and this is it, you know, and so anything these talking heads say is just, that's what happened and that's what we're telling you. But that is not how documentaries, that's not how you make one. It's certainly not how you edit one.
Yes. Like, yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. And that's a really good point, actually. I haven't really thought about it before, but yeah, when you do have documentaries that decide to only, to not have narration, but to only carry their story through talking heads, then actually that introduces a hell of a lot of subjectivity to what that documentary then delivers.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah.
It's interesting. While we're on the subject of talking heads, what do you think about the rest of the roster of interviewees that the film presents us?
Oh, I think it's really... It's really in depth. So like I say, like, you know, they certainly haven't skimped on the talking heads, and they're all people who properly have the right to be talking about this subject. You know, I was thinking that, you know, this was a real sort of golden age for Beatle talking heads almost, you know, like, so if you think about it, so a few of these people have already been involved in the anthology or interviewed for it, because there are a few people who are interviewed for it who then didn't really appear in it, not very much or not at all. So you can see it in Paul, that Paul is definitely, I really got the impression with Paul that, so he filmed this interview in November 1997, apparently, and he had spent most of, you know, large chunks of 1992 and 1993 recording interviews for the anthology. Mm. And you really get the sense that he knows how to do it, you know, he knows how to sit in front of a camera and tell an anecdote. And I think the way he talks about Brian is slightly odd, which I'm sure we'll get onto later. Mm. But also, like, you have all these people, like, you know, George Martin is still alive, and George Martin was always happy to talk about the Beatles, you know. Yeah. And but then, you know, and you have people like Peter Brown and Alistair Taylor, and these were people who were around at the time, you know. And like the reason I talk about it as a sort of golden age of Beatles documentaries is a lot of these people just aren't around anymore.
Yeah.
And but one of the reasons why sort of Mark Lewisohn is taking so long over these books is that he wants to put his time into like interviewing as many people as he can, eyewitnesses, while they're still around, you know, because, you know, that's the best way to use this time, you know.
You mentioned Alistair Taylor there, who is someone that I wasn't really aware of before this documentary.
Yeah.
So from what I understand from this documentary, at the time he was general manager of NEMS.
Mm-hmm.
But in 1998, he is man who strolls around lingerie aisles of an Ann Summers store dressed predominantly in a long trench coat.
Sure, sure.
it's a disarming image when that comes up, which is it the old NEMS store that he's walking around? So it's the so it is now an Ann Summers store, and there's a camera following him around whilst he's trying to explain the layout of the old NEMS store whilst surrounded by lingerie. And dressed in a long trench coat.
Yeah,
and it is it's not a, I don't think it does him any favours.
No, that's true. Yeah. No, I mean, so we were there this summer. Well, you know, so we were there when they unveiled the statue of Brian on Whitechapel.
That's great.
And we've done that walk that Alistair Taylor does from NEMS up Matthew Street up to the cavern. That was the interesting thing when they unveiled that statue, is we were standing in a place where they unveiled it and we kind of saw the back of his head.
Yeah.
which was an anticlimax.
That was so fantastic.
Yeah.
There was a massive crowd of people singing Beatles songs for about an hour whilst we waited for the unveiling, and the anticipation was palpable. Yeah. Like in the street, there was just a big crowd of people. It was very emotional, people getting quite teary-eyed whilst they were singing the latter refrains of Hey Jude for a really long time. Everyone was really getting into the moment.
Yeah.
And then eventually the countdown happened and they unveiled the statue. And it's like, oh, he's facing the other way.
Yeah, yeah. but there's a reason for that is he is facing, they have staged him in that statue doing that walk. That walk from NEMS where he walks up that one lunchtime and to go to the cavern for the first time. And it's really lovely the way that they thought to do it that way. But anyway, Alistair Taylor is doing that walk. And so on the way we hear, and he later on, the rest of his kind of main talking head staging is he's having a pint in the Grapes on Matthew Street, where we've also been.
Yeah. We didn't pay a visit to the Ann Summers store, though. Now I feel like that was a big regret.
Well, no, but I think it's now
it wouldn't be that.
Is it a Betfred now or something?
Oh, that's depressing, isn't it?
People from Liverpool would be able to tell. But I remember, because I wasn't 100% sure which store it was when we were on Whitechapel, and I forgot to look it up. But I think maybe it's a Betfred or something. But anyway, Alistair Taylor on the way is talking about why Brian took this walk is because people kept on coming into NEMS and asking for my Bonnie, and he wanted to know what it was. And on the way, Alistair Taylor sort of kills off the sort of a character who's sort of famous in Beatles lore, Raymond Jones, who was apparently, you know, the kid who walked in there and asked for the record.
I wasn't
Bonnie.
Aware of this before the documentary. I hadn't even heard the name before.
Oh, okay.
When you say it's famous in Beatles lore, this is the first time I'm hearing about
this. Oh, okay, okay. So he's the one. So in The Birth of the Beatles, do you remember I said there was a guy who was there was a kid who was played by a guy who went on to be one of the Scousers in Harry Enfield?
Yes, yes.
So at the time, I couldn't remember Raymond Jones's name, but that's Raymond Jones.
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay.
So according to Alistair Taylor, there was no Raymond Jones.
Yeah.
and it was just, you know, so many people came in that they needed to put someone's name on the order form. So he made up the name Raymond Jones, you know, and sort of ordered it. And so therefore he had to buy one himself. And so there's a journalist called Spencer Lee later on who tracked down the real Raymond Jones, who was surprised to hear that Alistair Taylor had said he didn't actually exist,
because
he very much does exist. And Mark Lewisohn has said that, yes, this is verifiably true, that Raymond Jones does exist and did go in there. So the reason I went on about that at such length, there is a reason, I promise, is that I find it really interesting because this is the point in sort of Beatles documentary history where talking heads are starting to realise that they can carve out a little bit of a name for themselves. Now, listen, I'm not saying that Alistair Taylor is making stuff up, but I do, you know, I think he probably just misremembered it or whatever it is, but I do think he is put it, to put it charitably, I think he's probably misremembered it in a way that puts him at the center of the story.
Yeah, but and that's interesting, isn't it? Because I think that's, without straying off topic too much, but I think that's just quite common anyway. I think anyone who wants to remember like a retelling a good story or a good anecdote or something is quite common for, you know, there's a big thing that happened. Like here's a big famous event. I was there and here's my inside take on it.
Yeah.
Which just positions me as an authority on the subject because it's not the take that you'd hear elsewhere.
Right.
But yeah, that's interesting because I think that the way what you said there about this is the point in Beatles documentary history, I think it probably coincides a little bit with just the Beatles legacy just becoming evolving into a bigger thing that later on becomes something that gets protected. And I think part of the protection of that legacy is almost to limit the number of participants a little bit. I think there's a tendency to be like, there's a core group that really know the story and actually, you know, the more that other names come into it, the more that gets diluted a bit. But so I wonder, there's a bit of a tendency for that to be like, you know, the Beatles story kind of starts and ends with Nems.
Mm.
Yeah. And this idea of this other kid coming in and contributing, it kind of just sort of downplays their involvement in that part of the history.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. And I think, because you have people like Peter Brown who are in it as well. But you also have, there's at least one other, a sort of older grey-haired guy who knew Brian and is in the documentary talking about knowing Brian, but who, if I'm honest, their name I can't remember. And that's kind of because of that thing about there is a sort of large cast of characters here and it's not always easy to remember who is who and the perspective from which they're talking, therefore. It's not doing that thing of, you know, sometimes to remind you, it will bring up their name on the screen every single time.
Yeah,
or at least more than once, every second or third time or whatever it is, you know, which they don't really do here.
Because I know exactly the person you're talking about, and it wasn't until he'd come back into the documentary like for the third or fourth time where I was like, oh, you seem to have a bigger role in this story than I'd first anticipated.
Mm.
And I actually went back to try and find out who it was and I couldn't find it. I didn't rewatch it again from scratch, but I was rewinding back through and trying to be like, you know, did at any point, did they actually say his name? That's what they did, but I missed it. At the other end of the spectrum, you've got a guy who is in the documentary who, off the top of my head, I couldn't tell you now what his relation to Brian Epstein and his story is at all.
Yep.
But I know for a fact that his name was apparently Yankel Feather.
Right, yes.
Because that's a name that appears on screen and you're not forgetting that anytime soon.
That is true.
So there's the two things happening there. There's faces, no names, and then there's brilliant names.
Yankel Feather is there for, I think he gives sort of one quote and I forget what he says because I was just too distracted by his name, if I'm perfectly honest. Yeah. And he is listed as artist and club owner, and that is the end of Yankel Feather.
Absolutely. Like,
you don't see him again.
Yankel Feather, now that I think about it, sounds like the kind of accessory that would be available in the Isle of an Amsterdam store. I'm assuming I've never been in one. I don't know.
No, me neither. No idea. I've never even heard of Ansonis. Like.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com.
Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And also, you know, you find with Peter Brown, so, you know, Peter Brown's another guy who was around a lot. He was a sort of personal assistant to the Beatles for a lot of their career. So he's talking about times when they were on tour. And he quite casually says, then we went to Japan where there was an attempt on their lives and da 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 da. And I was like, whoa, an actual attempt on their life. He mentions the word assassination. And I was thinking, I know there was a lot of controversy about them playing at the Budokan, and I'm sure there were death threats and things like that. But to be honest, that was not massively uncommon wherever they were going, but come 65, 66. Yeah. But in terms of an actual attempt on their lives, I'm not sure how verifiable that is. And it's just another thing of, I don't know, just people just quite casually, saying quite a big thing about their career that doesn't appear to be verified.
See, that's interesting because that stuck out to me as well.
Yeah.
And I thought that, yeah, that's a very strong way of phrasing that. But I just took it to mean he meant the death threats. But I guess the reason why that's different for me and you is that I didn't realise that there were any other instances of that happening before Japan.
Right.
So I guess from what I've seen in other documentaries and stuff, that's normally in relation to that tour.
Yeah.
Where that first started to happen. So I just assumed that he meant that and actually calling it an attempt on their lives.
Yeah.
Just over-egging. over-egging the perfectly innocent thing of a death threat.
yeah. Sure.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's been a bit dramatic.
Yeah, but I mean, come on, get over it, guys.
Yeah, a few hours under death threat. But yeah, that's what I took that to mean that as well. But yeah, you're right in the sense that this is another way in which some of the talking heads put their stamp on the narrative.
Yeah,
a little bit, and it does mean that it starts to contort the story a little bit.
A bit, yeah. But we had this in the Sergeant Pepper documentary. Mm. We were talking about the same thing of people have a habit of just putting themselves at the center of the story, which is maybe partly self promotion, but a lot of it, I think, is just human nature. As you say, it's almost human nature to sort of almost frame a story. You know, like how many times have you told an anecdote that actually happened to a mate of yours, but it's just a better anecdote if you say it happened to me, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, like, not big things, not like, not like I saved a child from a burning building or anything like that, but just sometimes, it's just an easier way to frame things.
Yeah, yeah, no, I
just
know what you mean.
It's a shorthand kind of thing.
I know what you mean. You
know.
Yes, yeah, yeah. And also, like, what's the point in telling the story if you're going to talk about something that happened to the Beatles that is in the public consciousness, mm. What's the point in telling that story unless you're giving your own perspective of that same story?
Yeah, yeah.
And then that automatically puts you at the center of that,
Yeah.
Shall we talk about the more Beatley elements of the Talking Heads?
Yeah.
This is going to sound quite strong. I apologise in advance.
Right.
This is the first instance, I think, of me seeing Paul McCartney in a film like this where I kind of actively dislike what he's saying.
Yeah.
I don't think he comes across well. I think that a lot of what he says has dated badly in terms of like kinds of phrases he uses around Brian Epstein's personal life.
Yes.
I think that's aged badly. I think some of the things he says is just comes across immediately as naive and really naff and cringy, which is perfectly in keeping, I think, with his reputation at the time, or his image at the time, I should say.
Mm.
But also, there's some stuff that he says where I kind of feel like it's distasteful, the way that he's saying it.
Yeah.
So let's break things down a little bit. The first time we see Paul McCartney on screen is within, I think, the first few minutes of the film. And the film starts... and I have problems with this as well, but the film starts with information about how Brian Epstein died.
Yeah.
And Paul McCartney's contribution to that narrative is, I think he just, was really sleepy. So he used to wake up and be like, oh, why am I awake? I'll just take some more sleeping pills.
Mm.
And it feels a bit like a very naive thing to a very naive explanation.
Yeah.
About it's the kind of thing that like your dad might say when he doesn't quite understand how drugs work.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? It's a bit like, oh, well, I mean, if you're taking sleeping pills, then you're too sleepy to realise whether or not you've taken any sleeping pills. So you just take more. Is that really what happens?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. That bit, I think it should be set in context. So there is, it's a TV or radio interview in, it might even be Desert Island Discs, but don't quote me on, well, you have to quote me on that. This is a podcast. I can't get around
it. It's on record now.
But, so there is an interview of McCartney, I think in the 80s, where the interviewer says, and of course, your manager, Brian Epstein, who killed himself in 1967. And Paul is very, very firm about, no, I don't like it when people say he killed himself. There's no evidence for that. And in fact, the inquest did not record a suicide. So when he, and he kind of mentions it in this documentary a bit, you know, oh, you know, people said he killed himself. I don't think he did, you know. So he is, I think, starting from a slightly defensive position. And I think that's maybe, and I agree with you, that does come across quite naive, but I kind of get why he's saying it.
I think it's, you know, you explain that. I think it's more the idea of the way he presents it is like a perfectly innocent situation that could have happened to one of the protagonists from Last of the Summer Wine or something. Right? It's like, okay. It's not like, you know, I understand that accidental overdoses happen.
Yeah.
Right. But there were
not in a bath going down a hill.
I think that his explanation kind of bypasses this idea of, you know, maybe it's just how it's termed, but, you know, when you talk about half empty bottles of barbiturates,
yeah,
that automatically takes on a tone to
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
Whereas his explanation is much more like homely and be like, yeah, I just thought he was a bit sleepy. You know? I thought maybe he'd just have some more pills, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just like, you know, there's not an ounce of grit to the fact that someone has died as a result of this. It's just this like silly little happenstance that's happened.
You know? I don't know. As I said, like, you know, I think he's got quite comfortable being a talking head now, post anthology, but I wonder if maybe he's got a bit too comfortable almost.
Yeah. I think at that point, I think he's now, you know, we covered McCartney 321 earlier, where, you know, he's obviously reeling out well-worn anecdotes there. I think he's much more self-aware of the image he's presenting as he's doing those kinds of interviews on camera. But I think in the anthology series, which obviously we'll get to eventually, and in this one here, this period, I don't think he's as self-aware of how he's coming across as he's saying that kind of stuff. Case in point, as well, is, I guess, you know, there's some of the later things he says in the documentary as well. He talks about without any concern or without any censorship, he'll talk about how my dad always thought Jewish people were good with money. So, like, you know, Brian Epstein's, you know, it seemed like a good choice for manager, like,
yeah,
you know. And I realize it's a different time, there's a different sensitivity or sensibility now to then, but there is a bit of a cringe aspect to not just what he says, but to some of the other talking heads as well, about certain phrases and terms they're using when talking about Brian or, you know, what's happened to him at the time.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Paul does that comment about what his dad said about Jewish people. Like, Paul does phrase that as, you know, that was kind of how people thought at the time. So he doesn't wholly distance himself from that view, and you know, I'm not saying that that is how he thinks, but if he were making this documentary now, he would be much more careful to distance himself from that and say that, you know, of course, you know, that's how people thought those times. Exactly. You know, I understand that's a stereotype, then it's not true. I think also, like, you know, so he says when he's talking about Brian's sexuality, he says, you know, he says, okay, well, the word was queer, not gay at the time, you know. And there's, and again, it, I mean, this is the result of, you know, this having been filmed in 1997 and released in 1998, is that actually, I just feel like he would have softened that a little bit. But he also, the way he talks about his sexuality, as he says, well, this, you know, we always kind of suspected that he might hit on one of us. Yes. And like, he says, I don't know the truth of the John rumor, which is problematic in itself. But then he says, but, you know, I slept with John a lot. You know, I slept in the same bed with John, you know. And so to my knowledge, John was never gay. And it's like, okay, but I mean, but the extension of that is basically what you're saying is if John did have any homosexual tendencies, then he definitely would have tried to get off with me.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Which is...
And there's a lot of... the way he talks around the whole subject of Brian's sexuality is problematic.
Yes.
Massively problematic.
Yeah.
I've written down here in my notes... that when the subject comes up about Brian's sexuality, one of the first things Paul says is, the great thing about it was, it didn't affect us at all. Which is like, good way to make his sexuality about you, Paul.
So true. Yeah.
But you're right. Like, in the John thing aside, there is a tendency to still mire Brian's personal life in this idea of it being something that was relatively shameful, or... You know, the language is used is like about it being secretive or something. He might have had like a hidden agenda, or who knew, or, you know, and it's just like this idea that it's, it's far less natural in a way, which is still, I guess, you know, these are present day sensibilities, being put upon a film that came out in 1998, but it still feels quite shocking now because we've moved on so much since then.
Yeah. Because like, you know, Paul's starting point, it's not even his fault necessarily, but like his starting point for the discussion, maybe he was prompted this way, is, well, he didn't fancy us. You know?
Yes.
This basically, you know, I want to make it clear, like, you know, obviously Brian was gay. He didn't fancy us, you know. Yeah. Where, like, obviously, you know, these days, there's no need to answer that question because nobody has asked you. You know?
Yes.
But I think there's a nice thing that Simon Napier-Bell says later on. He's a talking head here, as he is in the Sergeant Pepper documentary that we've covered before as well. And, you know, these are the only two Beatles documentaries I think I've ever seen him in, because he was a sort of friend and confidant of Brian's, and it's a very valuable one. He's actually quite underused, I think. And he says, I think it was less about him fancying any of the Beatles and more about the significance of him just sort of being a loner who's now been allowed into a group.
Yeah. I thought that was really insightful, actually.
Yeah, and he tells this really nice story about how Brian once sort of went to the back of the gig and screamed with the girls in a way, and just let himself go in a way he'd always wanted to. And I thought, well, that's lovely, you know. And actually, that is one of the few bits where someone is actually kind of getting into his personality rather than just... here's a guy who had inner demons.
Completely agree. Yeah. That's it. That felt like a revealing insight into a moment of Brian's life that says a lot about him as a person.
Yeah.
And this is me talking about this BAFTA-winning documentary, saying, I don't think there are enough of those in this BAFTA-winning documentary. Yeah. But I really don't. Like, I think that was sort of my main takeaway from watching it, was I really liked hearing that about him. And, I just didn't get a sense of enough of those kinds of moments from him. I could have done with more.
Yeah.
Just circling back to Paul, we should touch on what he says about John, because I found it really frustrating. He basically talks about how there are rumours about how John and Brian had some kind of sexual relationship.
Yeah.
But does that thing where he's like, well, I wasn't aware of it. So, like, you know, I didn't see it happen. I'm not saying it didn't, but as far as I'm aware, it probably didn't because I didn't see it, but who knows? I mean, what you're doing is adding fuel to the fire by not shutting it down.
Yeah.
And you're prompting speculation by saying what you're saying.
Yeah.
And I feel like there's no way he doesn't realize he's doing that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, definitely.
So what's his end game there? Like, why do that? Is he, it feels really odd. I think the film generally has an unnecessarily salacious approach to Brian anyway in covering his life. But that moment where Paul does that, it feels like unnecessarily distasteful.
Yeah, I was trying to sort of consider like where Paul was in life at the time when he records this interview. So like I say, he's obviously spent a lot of time doing the anthology. We're told that the process of going through the anthology really made him sort of reconnect with his feelings about being in the Beatles, and you know, and then you know, so this year that he records this interview, he's released Flaming Pie, which is, like he puts it, is, you know, I was sort of getting back to the way we recorded with the Beatles. Flaming Pie, you know, it has been probably his most critically well-received album since, I'm going to say, Tug of War or something like that. You know, it's been a long time since people have been saying this is a really good Paul McCartney album. Mm. And, like, we know he's very conscious of that kind of public opinion. So it's kind of at odds in a way, because also, you know, this is the start of his public rehabilitation. Like, you've got all the Britpop crowd in the 90s have been talking for the last 4 years or so about how great the Beatles are. You know, McCartney has been sort of invited into those into those circles as well. You know, he's done things like rocking up at Abbey Road with Weller and Noel Gallagher when they're recording that Come Together cover in 1995. You know, he's hip again, right? You know, people are saying, oh, people are thinking of Paul McCartney as, you know, his legacy is sort of on its way back to being rehabilitated as it is now. And it's strange that this just seems like a step back, you know, in terms of where he is, you know.
I kind of felt like it was a bit, because you're right, you know, on that path of rehabilitating his image, where we're at now, it felt like, for me at the time in the 90s, it felt like that was it restored then. And it's only now that you can see actually there are so many more steps that he wanted to make along that way, such as readdressing who actually wrote some songs and the credits for songwriting, and things like correcting this view of Lennon being the avant-garde person in the Beatles. You're going to take issue with that, aren't you?
You're right, actually, because this is he's released many years from now in 1997 as well, hasn't he? And
right.
That is the book in which he starts to do that thing.
So this felt like a little bit like, He's still a bit bitter at this idea of this total speculation on my part.
No, but it's,
but this idea that Lennon is still seen as the artistic one,
yeah,
and it's a really cheap way of sort of sticking the knife in a little bit and sort of harming his image, or not necessarily even harming it, but you know, just sort of changing the narrative a little bit in a kind of like a cheap way.
You see, it's interesting, yeah, because actually I hadn't thought, yeah, because like many years from now is when he starts to try and claw back some of that, and he's certainly when he makes his first real public land grab in terms of these songs were, you know, it has like it's quite unedifying in a way that book is. They're sort of going through songs and he's saying, well, I think that one was kind of 70% me, 30% John. So, and actually dividing them up into almost percentages, you know, which is just, you know,
it's a bit unseemly, isn't it?
It's a little bit unseemly, but I mean, in his defense, you can see why. And he is trying to get away from this idea that has existed, you know, since the Rolling Stone interview in 1970, but especially since John died, that, you know, John was the genius and this guy was the lightweight who backed him up, you know. So fair enough. So, yes, set in that context, if that book has come out in 1997 and now he's giving this interview, yes, it does make a bit more sense.
Yeah.
But it's still...
it makes sense, but it makes sense in a... It sort of makes me feel like it's a bitter sort of act to take to do that. Because I just don't feel like there's enough substance behind the notion of John and Brian having any kind of sexual relationship together for him to even warrant it any kind of airtime in an interview. But the fact that he does feels like it's an attempt to be sort of deliberately malicious in a way.
Yeah. And by the way, I mean, in more recent interviews, when that subject has come up, he said, no, definitely not.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And, you know, and it's not like he has any new information now that he didn't have then. Yeah. Right. So, there has been a change in attitude, I suppose. Yeah. A change in approach.
I think, again, it's that being self-aware of your image, like knowing how you come across when you're saying certain things. It's not necessarily reflecting on that person, but it's also reflecting on you for saying it. I think he's more aware of that now.
Yeah.
The other thing is Lennon and the use of footage or interview excerpts from him in this film. As much as Paul doesn't come across well in other ways, I don't think Lennon comes across particularly well either in this film. There are, and not least because of some of the language he uses, which, there are obviously very outdated terms that he employs here.
Yes.
But one of the very first things we hear him say, and I've never heard this before, I'm sure you probably have, is him talking about, I knew Brian Epstein very well, because if someone's going to manage me, I need to know them inside out. So I introduced him to pills, and then he says something about there being like a guilt association with his death there.
Mm.
And then basically explains that it was through introducing him to pills was to loosen him up enough to get Brian to come out to him as gay.
Right.
But the way Lennon explains it is almost like, I deliberately gave him pills in order for him to reveal information about himself to me that he otherwise might have been uncomfortable to.
Yeah.
And it feels like that's quite a manipulative thing to do. It doesn't seem particularly in keeping for someone that was otherwise a close friend.
Yeah. I think, actually, I think that the John interview footage is all from the Jan Wenner Rolling Stone interview. I think it's the audio tapes from that.
Right.
That is certainly credited in the credits at the end. Whether it's all from that, I'm not sure. But and so obviously that is the interview that set the tone for this whole idea of, you know, the differences in personality between Lennon and McCartney that kind of proliferated for so long and still do to some extent. And but it is famously a very, very caustic interview in which he is just killing every sacred cow that comes along that he can get his hands on. And, you know, who knows whether he even believed any of it or changed his mind 5 minutes later, as always with him. But no, you're right. It's odd, I suppose, think about the fact that, I mean, when this was being filmed, so George Harrison was still alive and Ringo is still alive, you know. So, I mean, I wonder if they were asked to be involved. I can imagine that George probably, I think he was pretty sick of the anthology stuff he only did that under Sufferance in the first place, I think. Mm-hmm. So probably would not have wanted to get involved. Ringo as well, I don't know. But I think there is an odd imbalance in terms of the Beatles talking about Brian, in that it's really only ever John and Paul that you hear from.
Yeah, so I was going to ask you about this because I'm basing this on much more limited, I guess, documentary films and stuff that I've seen compared to you.
Yeah.
I can't quite remember off the top of my head without a rewatch how much we have of George and Ringo talking about Brian in the anthology series.
Yeah.
And I wondered whether there might be other films that we'll end up watching and exploring in this podcast that will sort of change my mind about this. But right now, I'm of the same opinion. I don't really remember off the top of my head any interview I've seen where they talk about their relationship with Brian, which is weird because we are constantly told about what a good relationship Brian had with all four guys.
Yeah. Yeah. To be honest, I mean, you know, I've seen the anthology several times. And top of my head, I can't think of a lot. I can't think of specific quotes of George or Ringo talking about Brian.
Yeah.
It does seem to... Well, I mean, the inference you might draw from that is that, you know, John and Paul being the leaders, if you like, that sort of Brian was mainly dealing with them. I'm sure that's not the case.
Paul makes that point in this documentary, doesn't he? He says that he felt that John... He says specifically, whether or not this is true, he feels like John would have gone up to Brian and said, if you want to talk to the band about anything, it's all you come through me.
Yeah.
Again, I don't know if that's Paul sort of chipping away a little bit at John Lennon's image or reputation, because it's quite a pointed thing to say about someone.
Yeah, yeah.
But also equally, you can imagine that being true, the kind of personality that John was.
Yeah.
But there's still a long time that Brian would have spent with each of the band members, you'd have thought at least Ringo would be on camera saying a nice thing or two about Brian, right?
Yeah, because I mean,
you know, that's a bad word to say to anybody.
Yeah, and also, let's be honest, it's not that hard to get Ringo to be a talking head on your documentary.
No, exactly. Yeah.
He seems to be generally pretty happy to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but I mean, you know, who knows? You know, it's scheduling conflicts or whether they even just didn't ask him.
So I guess what I'm left with is an overall impression of the film that Brian Epstein is mostly remembered for being the manager of the Beatles, and of the four Beatles, the two that appear in the film don't actually come across very well at all.
Yeah,
and it's a bit of a sorry situation to be in, I think, where that's your main connection to sort of pop culture, and it just seems a little bit underserved by what we actually get in this film.
Yeah, I think so. Talking about, you know, the warmth that a lot of them talk about. A lot of the talking heads in the film talk about Brian. But there is, I think maybe it's Marianne Faithfull who like really stresses like how much he cared in a genuine way about not only the Beatles, but all, you know, the acts that he had, you know. So you've got sort of Billy J. Kramer is there saying, yeah, every time, if it was my birthday, he would always turn up and he'd always have a gift for me. And, you know, and if there was anything financial, you know, needed doing, you know, I think Jerry Marsden makes that point as well. And, you know, we're also told or reminded about how, you know, the Beatles moved from Liverpool down to London, which is a big deal, you know, because they're, I don't know, ranging from 21 to 24 or whatever they are at the time. You know, you're all moving to London. And, you know, and he set up George and Ringo in a flat on Park Lane, you know, and just... You know, that's proper sort of pastoral care. You know, it's not the actions of someone. You know, it sounds a lot like he didn't outsource that to someone else in his organization.
Yes,
I think it was the building that he lived in as well.
That's what they say.
That speaks to someone who was genuinely compassionate. You know, and you know, and I think near the end of the film, when Robert Stigwood is talking about the offer that Brian made him to take over, you know, a controlling share, and it sounds like what Brian wanted to do was just hand over the management of everything but the Beatles and just manage the Beatles himself.
Yeah,
and it sounds a lot like that's the thing that really gave him pleasure. You know. And as well as, you know, the theatre, which is something that he loved. And actually, you know, they get into that a bit in the documentary about, you know, him.
Yeah.
You know, him and the Savile Theatre, where he used to, you know, he used to run shows on Sunday nights. He'd have people like Jimi Hendrix playing there and things like that, you know. But yeah, and I think it doesn't quite serve him well enough with things like, you know, the passion for acting that he had, you know, because he had sort of attempts, I think, you know, before he was the Beatles manager, before he was running NEMS, I think he was he came down to London to study acting.
That's right.
You know, and was there for a little while. I feel like, the documentary really only kind of tells us things like this as a way of leading up to, and then he managed the Beatles.
Exactly. Yeah, you know? Yeah. I was going to say that. Yeah.
And yeah, and if you are trying to sort of get behind the man we think we know, which with its framing, like I say, with all the kind of slowed down footage and things, that seems to be what you're claiming to do. Get behind the. Get behind the image, that actually, if you're not going to flesh out things like that, then what are you really doing?
You know? Yeah, I think that's fair. I think to maybe to the film's credit, I think, you know, a lot of things you just said there are positive things that we understand about Brian based on what has come through, you know, in the talking head interviews that we've criticised the documentary for, but I do feel like they're details that we've had to glean for ourselves because the documentary isn't willingly giving that information to us. It's, you know, what we're sort of, what we're picking up, what we're doing to read between the lines about what kind of person he was based on what people are saying.
Yeah.
On a cheerier note,
yeah,
let's talk about how awful the music in this documentary is.
Sure.
Because the very first thing that struck me about this film when it started was that, first of all, the film opens with talk about how Brian Epstein died. There are lots of lingering shots of close-up pictures of Brian's face.
Mm-hmm.
And whilst we have talking heads talking about the circumstances of his death, the music that's playing in the background are really like sort of dark, ominous tones, some sort of spooky wailing going on.
Yeah.
It is absolutely the kind of thing that now would be reserved only for documentaries about serial killers and their victims.
Not even just now. I mean, yeah, at the time.
Yeah, sure. You know, yeah.
As well, I'm sure.
And it's this idea that this documentary seems preoccupied with there being sort of a hidden, shameful part of Brian's life. And I know that there is part of his life that he was forced to have to keep hidden.
Mm.
But for a documentary, a BAFTA-winning documentary, called The Brian Epstein Story, he seems much too preoccupied with that part of his life than his actual career and legacy.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, so, I mean, all this framing, which, you know, includes the music, and also lots of, as we said, when you're sort of doing audio clips, there's lots of sort of radio interviews with him that are very good and interesting sources, by the way, that we're hearing, but you need something on screen while that's happening.
Yeah.
And the choice they make quite often is that what we see is, there are TV screens that play images of Brian slowly, like he's been slowed down, and we see I think it's like the V hold on the TV where the do you remember when like the black bar sort of comes down every now and again?
Yes,
you know, yeah, so you're kind of seeing, and so this is almost, you know, it's quite a sort of postmodern technique of filming a television screen with the subject on it, as opposed to filming the subject, or showing you footage of the subject. What it's doing is kind of saying, this was a famous man, but also through the, through the slowing down. And by the way, this is not footage for him doing anything particularly other than just kind of standing there and talking to an interviewer or whatever. But it's slowed down, and really what that kind of says to you as a viewer is that there is something going on behind the scenes, you know, like we've slowed this footage down so that we can better explore, you know, the specific, facial mannerisms of this man who, you know, it's saying inner demons. This guy had inner demons.
Yes,
you know?
Exactly.
And that's the thing that that kind of serial killer framing suggests to you, because, you know, it's the same thing as this guy. You know, this guy who ended up killing 13 people was abused by his parents, and, you know, and all this kind of stuff. And it's exactly the same framing, right down to, as we've discussed before, the thing where you see a still image of someone and then it slowly focuses in on their eyes,
yes,
which is a classic serial killer framing. And it's such an odd creative choice. And I know, we've spoken before about films only having certain ways to express an idea to you. And it may be that, documentaries hadn't developed far enough at that time.
Well, yeah, and I was thinking about this because I think that, you know, there's a lot to be said for documentary as a medium having evolved so much since then that we now know documentarians know how to make certain choices that portray their subject in a particular way. There are rules now around how that's done. And maybe this film should be given certain allowances for the being the start of that sort of evolution of the medium.
Yeah.
But I can't imagine that the filmmakers weren't aware of the sense that they were giving with the choices they were making.
Yeah.
You know, it's very, very ominous, those terms are.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, there's a story being told. I guess, I spoke on a previous episode about how I always felt like in the anthology, Brian was given sort of fairly short shrift by just, there was the not that it was the only time you saw him, but there was the montage over You Got to Hide Your Love Away.
Yeah.
And I always thought that was quite reductive.
This film also employs. It's a cover of Hide Your Love Away plays as well.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, this is reductive in a slight... Well, it's reductive, but also it's suggesting something about him that, I don't know, it's like I say, the film just feels at odds with its talking heads, you know. They're saying warm things about him, and it seems to be going out of its way to imply a coldness about him.
I was told but didn't see in the film was constantly being told how charming and witty he is, and how he would always be able to hold his own with the boys, with the lads. But that's, you know, that's the talking heads telling me that. I'd have liked to have seen evidence of it, and instead the film is sort of giving me these sinister vibes, because it sort of seems more interested in the inner demons, like you say.
Yeah, but I suppose in his... So the footage that they have that could potentially show you that is the interview footage that exists of him, you know, the video and interview footage that exists, in which I'm not sure that his charm is particularly coming across in those interviews, because he was quite, because he was sort of quite proper in a way, you know, and when it came to, you know, I'm talking to the BBC, you know, I guess he's probably not being too charming or informal in that sense, you know, but there are bits where they use still images of him in quite effective ways at times. There's one where whichever talking head is talking, and you kind of start on his it's a still image of Brian in a suit, and he's standing up, and it starts at his feet and kind of slowly pans up, and this suit that you're seeing is it fits him perfectly, and it's so, you know, it's obviously nice and expensive, and, you know, and it's going up to, like, you know, there's going to be like an image of a man who is like completely put together, and then in his face, when they get to his face, there's just an uncertainty, as there kind of always was in his face, you know. And but, you know, I feel like that was kind of whether they intended that or not, I have no idea, but I found it quite effective. But it's odd that they're kind of using some of these quite subtle techniques, if that was a technique, versus this sort of odd sledgehammer technique, you know, of the eerie music and all the rest of it, you know.
And again, on the music, I know we've talked about the sort of eerie type music that we've talked about there, but elsewhere in documentary, the music is equally dreadful in different ways, I find. I always feel like the music choices... and this is purely incidental music that's being played in sort of in the background scenes, not the songs that they're choosing. But it ranges from the dramatic choir at the Epstein Synagogue at the start of the film, which feels like this is a big epic, like almost like you'd have in like a horror film religious horror. To when Alistair Taylor's in the Ann Summers store, there's sexy jazz playing.
Yeah.
and it just, like, there's no, the through line is show what's happening on screen and then dial it up 1,000.
Yeah.
That's the sense I got from it. I thought it was tonally all over the place and always inappropriately too much. That's just a problem I had in general that I really need to get off my chest.
Yeah, and there's some of, I mean, you know, there's always that thing of, like, whenever 1967 comes up, and lots of documentaries guilty of this, it's here's the sitar music, you know. Yes. And in this instance, maybe just to make it more eerie, it's kind of like the sort of snake charmer.
Yes, that's right. Yes. Well, there's
I couldn't tell you what that instrument
is. It's like a
woodwind
part in it, which I thought was really odd.
Yeah.
Almost like a pan flute or something that just sounded very strange.
Well, I think that covers everything for the Brian Epstein story. Anybody listening at home, what did you think about the film? Have you seen it? Do you agree with us about where the documentary works and where it doesn't work? Let us know. You can contact us on all the usual social media platforms at Beatles Films Pod. You can also leave us a review of this particular episode or any other episode you've listened to and enjoyed on the series. Otherwise, we will see you again for a new episode next week. Thanks for listening and bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.